This week on World Affairs, why should Americans care about Ukraine? I'm Philip Young, CEO of World Affairs. One question at the heart of the impeachment case against Donald Trump is whether the president threatened to withhold U.S. military assistance from Ukraine. For better or worse, Ukraine, Trump, and impeachment will be forever linked in American history books. In this episode, we explore why the U.S. has been supporting Ukraine in Europe's only active war, and why does Ukraine need to defend itself against Russian aggression? World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED, and it's made possible by the generous support of Chevron and TPG. And now to Ray Suarez.
First, we start with Simon Ostrovsky. He's a filmmaker and journalist, and has spent extensive time reporting from the front lines of Ukraine's war with Russia, most recently for PBS NewsHour. He joins us from Nicosia, Cyprus. Simon Ostrovsky, welcome to World Affairs. It's great to have you.
Hi there.
Awareness has grown in the U.S., in Ukraine, in fact, around the world, that Ukraine policy was a matter of contention here in Washington and is now even rocking the Trump administration. What was the reaction in Ukraine itself?
In Ukraine, I think politicians are walking a delicate balance right now as they try to figure out what their relationship is with the United States. Because for President Zelensky, who, if some of your listeners don't know, was elected just earlier this year and has no previous political experience, he was an actor whose latest role had actually been playing the president in a TV show, but had no real political experience. For Zelensky, right now he has to find a way of maintaining the U.S. support that his country has been getting since before actually the war began with Russia in 2014, and B, not angering Donald Trump. And that's a difficult thing for him to do because, as we know and as has emerged in these impeachment hearings and now in some of the evidence at the impeachment trial, Donald Trump and an array of his associates and figures from his administration have put a lot of pressure on Zelensky and people around him to announce an investigation into Joe Biden and Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden. And at the same time, you know, Zelensky hasn't been able to come out publicly to say that that pressure has actually happened, because he doesn't want to make the American president unhappy. It's even complicated further by the fact that no one knows who's going to win the American presidential election later this year. So Zelensky has to keep that in mind. You know, the Democrats could well come into power at the end of this year, or the beginning of next year, rather. And then whatever he does now might be remembered either fondly or negatively by them. And, you know, that would be a reality that he has to deal with then. So I think the sort of takeaway from all of this is that the Ukrainians are in a very difficult position, and they have to be very diplomatic and careful about what they say and do.
Well, the situation in Ukraine is not static. It hasn't been standing still all this time. It's dynamic. It's been moving since the famous phone call between the newly elected president and the president of the United States. Is Ukraine, in military terms, more secure, less secure since that famous phone call?
I don't want to exaggerate the situation on the front lines in eastern Ukraine. The war there has been going on since 2014. If you'll remember, the Russian authorities invaded and then annexed Crimea. But in eastern Ukraine, the situation is different. The Russians have sent troops there, and they've supported local forces that are pro-Russian since the war began in 2014. But they've just stopped short of actually annexing the area in eastern Ukraine and joining it to Russia. The hot phase of the war was in 2014 and in 2015. And the Russians were able to take control of two major cities, Donetsk and Luhansk, and about an area in which about 3 million Ukrainians had lived previously before the war started. The population's really dropped there now, but nobody knows exactly how many people have left and how many are remaining. The front line itself is about 250 miles long, and it's been relatively static since 2015, And there's this sort of uneasy, simmering war, which still takes lives on a weekly basis. But what isn't happening is the front line isn't moving. So it's not dynamic in the sense that there are counterattacks and, you know, pushes into new territory. No new territory has been lost since the town of Debaltseve was taken over in 2015, as far as I know. And so while the war is sort of on a low simmer that maybe takes one or two lives every week, there hasn't seemingly been a risk of all-out war for quite some time now, I think mostly because that's the sanctions that have been put in place against Russia and you know, Ukraine's persistence in defending what remains of its territory in the east have sort of slowed Russia's appetite. Now, when this pressure was taking place, when Trump's associates and members of his administration were threatening to pull aid unless the Ukrainians announced that investigation into the Bidens, you know, this had been behind closed doors for a long time. But when it came out and when it became public because of the whistleblower complaint, that, of course, sent a message. It sent a message both to the Ukrainians, but more importantly, it sent a message to the Russians. And I think that a lot of people are interpreting that the message that that was sending was essentially that America's backing of Ukraine is not 100% guaranteed, i.e. it's conditional on these personal favors that Donald Trump is asking. That really weakens Ukraine's position at the negotiating table, because then now the Russians can say, hey, you know, we want X, Y, and Z from you, and you don't know if the United States is going to be there to support you, to stop us from getting it. So you better make a deal that's favorable to us. And in fact, you know, we saw something like that happen in December. I was covering the war in the East for PBS NewsHour weekend in December. I visited Eastern Ukraine and traveled all along the front lines. Ahead of a negotiation between Volodymyr Zelensky and Vladimir Putin of Russia, which was in Paris. And, you know, Ukraine didn't get any major concessions out of Russia at that sit-down, at that talk. In fact, the United States and Donald Trump didn't make any significant statements of support for Ukraine ahead of those negotiations. And so the front line remains exactly where it was. There was a major prisoner exchange that took place, but that was good for both sides. It wasn't just in Ukraine's favor. And so Ukraine wasn't able to negotiate any major concessions from Russia. And, you know, potentially that's a result of the fact that American support for Ukraine is on the wane, it seems, under this president for the time being.
Well, okay, that's the perception of where President Trump is. But during the impeachment process in Washington, there have been plenty of forthright and repeated declarations of support from Republicans in Congress, from Democrats in Congress, about the essential nature of supporting the Ukrainian government and about the necessity of the United States making it clear where it stands. Is there a potential slingshot effect here that the process itself, while it dredged up some dirty laundry behind the scenes, may have also put a lot of people on the record that the continued support of the United States for Zelensky is important?
Well, this has been the story of the Trump administration really from before day one. We've seen a situation where the Trump has been unwilling to make declarations of support for Ukraine, while at the same time he's been very happy to praise Ukraine's opponent, Russia, its leader, Vladimir Putin. And so the various gestures of support that we have seen from this administration, and there have been some, have happened under immense pressure from Congress. So it's always seemed like it was Congress forcing Donald Trump's hand and not Donald Trump doing something on behalf of Ukraine out of his own desires to do so. Because one of the very first things that Donald Trump, the candidate, in 2016 outlined was that in the Republican platform, they had deleted A couple of sentences in there that said that the Republican Party wanted to give lethal weapons to Ukraine in its fight against Russia, because that would have been a major change in policy from the Obama administration. Under Obama, there was a lot of financial support and civilian support and military support for Ukraine, but it stopped short of giving them weapons that could kill. It was mostly things like artillery radars that allowed them to know where they were being fired on from, and medical support and training and things like that. But, you know, nothing that shoots and goes bang. And so, you know, the Republican Party opposed that during the Obama administration in Congress. And most of the Republican platforms of the other candidates said that they wanted to provide shooting weapons to Ukraine, except for the Trump administrations. They changed that part of the Trump's platform during the convention. So eventually, you know, senators and House members did push weapons for Ukraine through under Donald Trump, but it wasn't because he wanted it. And so these Javelin anti-tank missiles that they'll bring up all of the time when they talk about how Donald Trump gives more support to Ukraine as compared to the Obama administration, that was something that Congress forced him to do.
So if you're on the ground in the Donbas wearing a Ukrainian uniform, what do you make of the whole thing? I mean, this is unusual territory for what is still, in world political terms, still a young country trying to figure out, unfortunately pressured by a much larger neighbor, where its borders are and who its friends are. What do Ukrainians themselves, whether in uniform or living in some of these contested areas, think about where the U.S. stands?
You know, I spoke with civilians and soldiers when I was out on the front lines in December, and some of the soldiers told me that they were saddened by the developments because, you know, they get echoes of what's happening in Washington and Kyiv, where they're at, over the internet and over the radio. They hear what's happening, and it's definitely not heartening for them. And, you know, part of the success of any kind of military campaign is obviously morale. And I think it has led to slippage in the morale of Ukrainian soldiers. So that's, you know, something that you can chalk up on the negative side of the column in Ukraine's war with Russia. And on the other hand, though, I was speaking to people who were coming across one of the several checkpoints that there are from the occupied separatist areas that come into Ukraine-controlled territory, and talking to people just to find out what they hoped would come out of the negotiations between Putin and Zelensky. And I've got to tell you, 9 out of 10 people that I spoke with said that they had hoped that a resolution would be achieved in which the occupied areas were returned to Ukrainian control. Now, that's a very different sentiment from what I heard from people on the ground when I was initially covering the war when it had broken out early on in 2014. Because at that point in time, you know, people had been ginned up by Russian state television and various disinformation campaigns to believe that Nazis had taken power in Kyiv and that they were about to come to eastern Ukraine to murder anybody who spoke Russian. And so at that time, people were genuinely fearful and thought in the east that they needed Russia to come and protect them. Now, having seen what happened in Crimea, which was joined to Russia, and having seen what's happening in eastern Ukraine, which wasn't joined to Russia and left in limbo without status, people living there, understandably, have gotten very tired of living in this halfway house where the area is run by these sort of marionette puppet regimes that are called the Luhansk People's Republic and the Donetsk People's Republic, but aren't internationally recognized. And so people really don't see a future for themselves in these areas that don't have status. And I think it's grinding and difficult to live in those conditions. And now they're looking back, you know, 5.5 years after the fact and thinking to themselves, you know what? Things were better before. We just want things to go back to normal. You know, that was surprising for me to hear that from people there.
So are you saying there's a resurgence of Ukrainian nationalism, Ukrainian national identity? Are people looking at, well, maybe we didn't know how good we had it and looking back and saying maybe we just want to be an unremarkable part of Ukraine again?
Well, if we're talking specifically about the East, I wouldn't say that it's a resurgence of nationalism, but yes, the latter part of what you were saying. We'd like to just see things go back to normal, how they were before the war when we were just a regular, you know, forgotten region of Ukraine. But if you're talking about the country more widely, then there has been a resurgence of Ukrainian nationalism, Ukrainian patriotism, Ukrainian self-awareness, call it what you will, that is a direct result of the war. The war, like nothing else, reminded people that their independence was not something that they could be handed for free without any cost. And the difference, I think, now between the Ukraine of now and 5 years ago is that, you know, many Russian-speaking Ukrainians, although they're Russian-speaking, see themselves first as Ukrainian citizens and Russian-speaking people in second place. So I think Ukraine is really sort of growing into its identity as a bilingual country called Ukraine, rather than a country with a Ukrainian-speaking population and a Russian-speaking population that could never live together. And I think that's the real lesson here for the Kremlin and for the rest of the world is that, you know, you might be able to invade and take a chunk of a country, but you're going to lose the country as a whole as a result of that war and violence that you've started there.
And Simon, one final question. This is an election year here in the U.S., and American election years tend to gain a lot of interest in other places in the world. Is there a high awareness of it in Ukraine? Are there people who are just rolling the dice and seeing what the outcome of the election here will be?
Well, for me, you know, one of the big takeaways of the impeachment hearings and the impeachment trial is the lessons that I think authoritarians and just corrupt individuals from around the world are learning from this whole episode, which is that if you are able to get a message to the President of the United States about, say, a U.S. official like Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch, where you spread a rumor that she's been bad-mouthing the president, you can get that official fired. That's the real scary thing that's happened here. I think people have taken note how easy it is to manipulate this White House and get American policy changed on the ground where it matters for them. Because the Ukrainian government isn't a monolith. The Ukrainian government is made up of many actors, like in any democracy. I mean, Ukraine is much more similar in that sense to the United States than Russia, where it does all come down to what Putin wants at the end of the day. It's not all about what Zelensky wants at the end of the day. And there could be bad actors within the Ukrainian government who are looking for personal gain for themselves, and they could go against government policy and realize that it's very easy to manipulate the White House and, you know, get the personnel changes that they want. And that's what we saw happen with Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch. She got fired through the machinations of Rudy Giuliani, Lev Parnas, and Igor Fruman. And you know what? It wasn't that hard, as we heard from the recording that Lev Parnas released recently. So that's the big takeaway from all of this for me.
Well, stay tuned. Simon Ostrovsky, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
And now we're joined by John Herbst. He was U.S. ambassador to Ukraine from 2003 to 2006. He heads the Eurasia Center at the Atlantic Council. Welcome to the program, Ambassador.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Oksana Shevel joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's a professor of political science at Tufts University. Professor, a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
Well, let's dig right in. Support for Ukraine by the Trump administration has been depicted as strong in the back and forth of the impeachment trial and the hearings that preceded it. Ambassador, is it?
It's a very unusual situation. The president's own instincts seem to be rather soft towards the Kremlin and Putin, but his advisors have all had what I consider to be very sound views that Putin's pursuing an aggressive foreign policy that challenges key American interests. And of course, Ukraine has had strong support in Congress from both Republicans and Democrats. As a result of the people within the administration, as a result of the congressional support, Trump's policy overall has probably been tougher on Russia and more supportive of Ukraine, with the exception of that very unfortunate incident last year where the president was withholding aid for political reasons.
So you're saying that despite appearances, the Trump administration has been pretty good on Ukraine?
With the exception, and that's a very important exception, of the several months where Trump was withholding aid, which he should not have been doing.
Professor, how do you think this is being perceived by people in leadership in Kiev?
I think people in leadership in Kiev obviously need strong bipartisan support from the United States. So there has been very careful, so at least open rhetoric from the part of the Ukrainian leadership not to anger, clearly look like supporting one party or the other. But I think definitely, I would say this unfortunate scandal following the phone call and the current, you know, discussions in the U.S., in the Congress and the Senate, I think potentially could weaken Ukrainian reform agenda, because the U.S. rhetoric about needing to fight corruption and support clean politics, given how Ukrainian president was pressured to do something, we can say, quite corrupt act, I think might have negative repercussions down the road, that the narrative about supporting clean politics and fighting corruption might be perceived more skeptically in Ukraine. And I think that also indirectly at least helps Putin, because his narrative has always been that everybody is corrupt and, you know, I'm no better or worse than these other so-called corruption fighters.
I'm assuming that a lot of communication goes back and forth that the public never hears about. Has Ukraine been reassured by Washington that the American commitment is solid, that the United States, as a matter of policy, is committed to Ukrainian independence?
Yes, I think the fortunate situation for Ukraine is that indeed there is, I think, this commitment as part of U.S. foreign and security policy, and we can say national interest. So even when President Trump was elected and given his rhetoric on the campaign trail, as Ambassador was saying, very, we can say, warm towards Putin, right, there has been fears in Ukraine, I think, on the part of many that U.S. foreign policy might shift. But exactly, I would also agree that given that it's not just one person making policy in the U.S., the president in his instincts that may be more pro-Russian and to some extent anti-Ukrainian, given certain things that he believes Ukraine had done, allegedly, still U.S. support continued, right? Ukraine received military aid. It receives continued support from both parties in the U.S. government. So in that sense, I think it's somewhat fortunate that regardless of personal opinions or preferences of an individual who's U.S. president, there is broader interest on the U.S. And as a democracy, these other interests play a role, and it's never up to one person to make foreign policy.
Ambassador, what do you think?
I don't think there's any question that support on both sides of the aisle in Congress for Ukraine remains strong, and I think that therefore they can count on further American support. In fact, it's interesting that December, right, the month when impeachment flared, Congress voted one to kill Nord Stream 2, which is an oil project, excuse me, a gas project, which is designed to hurt Ukraine, a Russian-German gas project. And they also voted to authorize additional military assistance for Ukraine. And again, this is when impeachment was flaring loud, but Republican lawmakers joined their Democratic colleagues with both of these pro-Ukrainian measures.
But is it significant that you're mentioning Congress and lawmakers and not the president? Would a signal from the president have mattered, for instance, when President Zelensky, still pretty new in the job, was getting ready to meet up with an old hand at this kind of thing, Vladimir Putin?
There's no question that if President Trump were to echo the sentiments of his secretaries of state and defense, our policy would be stronger and better and Ukraine would be assured. It's also true that Kurt Volker did a great job as our special envoy for negotiations between Ukraine and Russia, and not having him in the job is unfortunate. But just before those Paris talks that you referred to, Phil Rieker, who's the acting Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, and George Kent, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, were in Kiev performing the Volker function.
Professor, what do you think? Was President Zelensky's hand weakened in the bilateral with Russia's Putin by the absence of clear signals from not Congress, which has been pretty stalwart and pretty bipartisan in its support of Ukraine, but from the President of the United States.
Well, more support is always better than less support. So in that sense, we can say, of course, there has been some strong message from the President of the United States. It could only help and not hurt Ukraine's hand. On the other hand, I think if we look at the outcome, say, of the Paris summit, right, I don't think Ukraine did so badly there. I think Ukraine actually did quite well. It did not concede any of what, many in Ukraine consider absolutely important, vital red lines. To Putin as far as the Donbass settlement having to do with federalization of the country that Putin has long wanted or some other major concessions. It managed to release prisoners, which was very important for a Ukrainian president and for the Ukrainian public. So I think overall, even despite this, we can say, explicit show of support from President Trump, I think President Zelensky came out quite successfully from this summit. So the absence of Trump's specific support, rhetorically or otherwise, I don't think hurt Ukraine all that much in that particular time period.
Professor, whose initiative was the Paris summit? When these two presidents got together, whose hand was behind it? Was this something that Zelensky was angling for, or was this done as a Putin initiative?
I think that Zelensky ran his campaign, if we remember, one of the key promises, in addition to fighting corruption, was to bring peace to Donbass. Because for Ukraine, even though the conflict is often described in Western press as a so-called frozen conflict, it's not really frozen. It's probably better description would be low-intensity conflict. And Ukrainian servicemen are dying all the time, and that really takes a toll on the sort of public morale. And most people in Ukraine, polls clearly show, want peace. So when Zelensky got elected, he was hoping that he could basically reach some settlement with Putin. He talked about it during his campaign. Many people believe that he's very inexperienced. He doesn't understand Putin. He would not be a strong negotiator. So I think the interest certainly was on the Ukraine's part to reach, to make some progress. Putin may have had and probably did have his own expectations, probably in part, again, because he was dealing with less experienced, at least in foreign policy, politician, that the summit might bring some benefits to his agenda. But again, as I said, I think the outcome, given what has been agreed and what has not been conceded, I think Zelensky did pretty well. We can say it might be unfortunate that no major breakthrough was achieved, but what has been achieved has been quite beneficial to Ukraine and certainly to families whose loved ones came back.
So, Ambassador, you look at this as an old Ukraine hand. There's been the bilateral between Russia and Ukraine. There's the domestic situation in the United States. There's the international relations situation in the United States. Will the U.S. and the European Union's commitment to Ukraine show, have a mark, leave fingerprints on whatever the final deal is between Ukraine and Russia to address the ongoing crisis? Is there going to inevitably be some sort of, either by its presence or its absence, a show of just what these big powers, the EU and the U.S., want to see happen?
The U.S. and the EU are critical players in the conflict that Russia began in Ukraine. Without strong support from Washington and from Brussels, Ukraine's ability to withstand Kremlin aggression would be much smaller. And I am confident that support in Washington for Ukraine will continue because Moscow's policy, its aggressive foreign policy, is challenging key American interests. So stopping Kremlin aggression in Ukraine is much smarter than having to deal with Kremlin aggression in a NATO country.
Well, what does a win look like for Ukraine? I mean, as the rest of the world sort of looks on and waits to see what shakes out, what should we be looking for? What does it look like if Ukraine gets a good deal and gets a win out of this situation?
It's actually pretty simple. A good deal is Russian troops, Russian money, Russian activity in eastern Ukraine ceases. Ukraine gets back control of the border with Moscow. It reclaims its territory, which is currently occupied by the Kremlin in Donbass. And there's essentially a peace. And the difficult issue of Crimea is put off to the future. I think this will happen. It'll happen the moment when Putin realizes he has no chance of winning in Ukraine. Many people in Moscow understand that Putin's policy is a failure, but Putin is not one of those people who understands it.
Professor, do you agree with our reporter, Simon Ostrovsky, that in eastern Ukraine, there's a sort of weariness with the whole thing, that people eventually want to end up inside Ukraine and not inside Russia, and that in the rest of the country, Russian speakers are coming around to the idea of being Ukrainian.
Right. I would certainly agree that in the rest of the country, meaning in government control territories, there has been an increase in, we can say, pro-Ukrainian sentiment and Ukrainian civic identity since 2014. But in fact, this process actually started even sooner. If we look at the election results going back to the early 1990s, the so-called border between the more kind of pro-Russian and pro-Western, pro-Ukrainian candidates has been shifting since 1991. But I think we should be careful when we generalize about opinions of people who are currently on the non-government controlled territories, because there is no reliable polling that comes for obvious reasons. It's, you know, people are afraid, and the current authorities in control don't make it really easy to conduct independent polling. To the extent we do have some polls coming out, it seems to be quite a difference of opinion between, say, government-controlled Donbass and non-government-controlled Donbass. And yes, I would agree with Simon Ostrovsky that most people just want peace. But I think as far as if, say, Russia were to annex eastern, you know, Donbass, which they're not going to, they could have done it a long time ago if they wanted to, I don't think people there would necessarily be that upset. Now, since this option is no longer on the table and people are thinking, okay, like, do I want to live in this no man's land with some documents that have no validity anywhere and no future for my children, right? Or do I want to be in Ukraine? I think that's certainly reasonable to think that many people would prefer to be in Ukraine. And yet, you know, Ukrainian government, if and when it takes control of this territory, would have to think about things such as, say, language policy, memory politics, that would be acceptable to people in that part of the country. So here, I think, on the one hand, I would agree with Ambassador, solution is simple, meaning that, you know, Ukraine regains control of this territory, regains control of the borders, Russian troops leave. But then I think there would be still many things that would need to be sorted out, as to how Ukrainian government, central government, would deal with the populations in this country, given that there has been legitimately, not to say that, you know, Russia didn't play a role in the whole crisis and played a central role, but the opinions of population, especially in 2014, has been quite against central government. And these opinions, at least for some people, certainly only hardened as a result of the conflict. So Ukrainian government would have a difficult task, I think, to figure out what kind of policies, especially in the humanitarian sphere, it can pursue to further integrate these territories, not just on the maps, but in reality, in the sort of hearts and minds, to bring the population in currently occupied parts of Donbas together with the people in the rest of Ukraine.
You're listening to World Affairs, a weekly broadcast produced in partnership with KQED. I'm Philip Yan. We're talking about Ukraine's strategic importance to the United States. Our guests are John Herbst. He was U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine from 2003 to 2006, appointed by George W. Bush. Now he's director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. And Oksana Shevel, a professor of political science at Tufts University. Earlier, Ray spoke with filmmaker and journalist Simon Ostrovsky, who has been reporting from the front lines of Ukraine's war with Russia. To hear this program or any other World Affairs episodes, you can download our podcasts on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs. That's one word. And now back to Ray Suarez in Washington.
Well, Professor, if you're watching this, trying to understand the situation, reading the newspapers, watching the news, on the west coast of the United States, let's say, it all seems very far away and sometimes a little mysterious that Russia is so vitally interested in what's been an independent country since the early 1990s. It seems to have a lot of stake both in national pride, in power projection, in wanting to have cultural influence. Help us understand both Ukraine, its desires for independence, and also Russia's interests in keeping a firm hand on that part of the world.
Right. Well, I think we have to kind of look historically to really understand this, as you said, indeed would be quite peculiar situation to people not familiar with the history of that part of the world. In Russian, we can say sort of national memory, right? Ukraine really plays a central part. I mean, it goes back to the historical narrative of the origins of the Russian, Ukrainian, and Belarusian people, the Kievan Rus, which was its center, medieval kingdom, right, was a center in Kiev. And and many Russians believe that really these people constitute one nation in almost like biological sense. So in other words, and Putin, by all accounts, from what we can say, really does have this worldview that Ukrainians, Russians, and Belarusians comprise really one people in, again, almost biological sense. So in that understanding, right, having Ukraine separate and go its own way, it's like a body losing an arm, right, for lack of better analogy. So that's kind of philosophical, you know, slash identity part. And then also, you know, given the central role Ukraine has played as part of both the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, right, losing control of Ukraine, and especially given the tense relations between Russia and the West, if Ukraine really becomes... It joins the Western camp, God forbid, as far as they think in Moscow, joins NATO, that was really a red line for the Kremlin. It somehow weakens what they consider to be essential, true objective, like what objectively should be Russian, greater Russian state. So Ukraine has huge stakes for Russian both identity, its historical self-understanding, and for its current geopolitics. So it's not just a territory that happens to be on the Russian border. It does have this additional significance that, say, maybe, you know, Latvia, that Russia also borders, does not have. So I think to understand Putin's current policy and interest in what's going on in Ukraine, and especially this kind of knee-jerk reaction after 2014 when Yanukovych was ousted and Euromaidan movement won, that may be kind of the historical turning line of Ukraine turning towards the West and leaving Russian sphere of influence. I think it produced this reaction kind of crisis in Russia and led to the annexation of Crimea and the start of the so-called Russian Spring. And of course, they hoped that it wouldn't just be this unrecognized little territory, but they really hoped at the time that several eastern and southern Ukrainian regions might essentially, if not outright leave Ukraine, then certainly create kind of a bigger quasi-state that would slow and prevent the movement of the whole country westwards. That didn't happen, but I think the reaction itself we have to put in this perspective of historical significance of Ukraine to Russian self-understanding as a nation.
Ambassador, give us the view from Washington, because a lot of this, well, I think was begun with a lot more optimism and a lot more positive feelings about this part of the world. The borders were agreed to after the breakup of the Soviet Union. The transfer of military assets from Ukraine to the successor state of the Soviet Union, basically Russia. They worked out some agreements about the Black Sea, about the port of Sevastopol. A lot of things happened where you thought, all right, you know, it's messy in some spots, but it's kind of moving on and it looks like it's going to work. What happened?
Well, I think there was undue optimism about this part of the world turning out the right way. And undue optimism because Washington did not understand in the 90s that there remained in essentially the ruling class in Russia this imperial conception of themselves, which Oksana just outlined, so that Russia had a right to tell what its neighbors what they could and could not do. So we were naive. And we should remember that, one, Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons because Russia and the United States and Britain and France and, for that matter, China all assured Ukraine that its borders would remain its borders. So we did not quite meet our commitments on that score. But there's something else that's important here. Maybe it's a little bit in the weeds for your listeners. But Oksana outlined the Russian interpretation of history. But that's not the only interpretation of history. There's the Ukrainian interpretation of history, which says that Ukraine has never been part of Russia except as forcibly incorporated, and that Kiev and Rus is not necessarily the origin of Russia as it exists today, but the origin of Ukraine, an independent Ukraine, as it exists today. And finally, it needs to be understood that this whole crisis began when Moscow said to Ukraine, to then-President Yanukovych, that joining a trade deal with the European Union was unacceptable. So this was not about NATO. This was about not even EU, a EU membership, but simply a trade deal with the EU. And that's what led to the crisis, which led to Kremlin aggression.
Are there ghosts of the 1990s, though, reaching out that sort of complicate the story? You know, there's a very strong narrative in diplomatic circles on both sides of the Atlantic that Russia was either formally or informally promised that NATO would never reach the Russian frontier. And then when the Baltic states were allowed to join and also join the EU, There were noses out of joint in Moscow, and the West was seen as having broken either an explicit or implicit promise. And then when Ukraine, as Oksana, Professor Shevel says, in many Russians' mind, an integral part of this this cultural and political zone started looking west as well, that was just a bridge too far.
This is certainly the narrative that the Kremlin has pushed to justify its aggression. And my understanding, and I think the best writer on this has been Mark Kramer up at Harvard, that regarding the ending of the Cold War, the coming down of the Berlin Wall and so on, Moscow was told that Western, actually it was the unification of Germany, which was the issue at play, that Western forces would not be deployed into Eastern Germany if it became part of a unified Germany. No other promises were made regarding NATO enlargement. The key point is this, though. The Russian doctrine that they have a right to determine what happens in their neighboring countries was in play starting in 1991 when there was no talk of NATO enlargement. That's when the whole Russian play of frozen conflicts began in Georgia, in Moldova, in Nagorno-Karabakh. And they also played games in Ukraine at that time.
Right. That was when people in this part of the world first started to hear the phrase, the near abroad.
Correct.
That Russians used to refer, or probably still do refer, to the countries that border core Russia as the near abroad. That they have a sphere of influence there, just as a Westerner might think that the United States has a sphere of influence, for instance. And it was being violated. So, well, Kyrgyzstan is one thing, or Turkmenistan is one thing, but is Ukraine different? Is Ukraine just, as Professor mentions, along with Belarus, something different about those countries as opposed to the more fringe areas of the old Soviet Union?
I think your question is a topical one. But the answer is only yes if you believe that the aspirations of the Ukrainian people and the Belarusian people had to be sacrificed for the imperial narrative of history that is common in Russia. If the Ukrainian people don't get a say in this, your question has currency. If we believe Ukraine has a right to determine its own future, then I think the answer to your question is no.
Ah, but that, Professor, gives a challenge to Ukraine, how to play the current situation. Can a government in Kyiv freeze the game in place, slow walk ongoing management of its relationship to the U.S. and its relationship to Russia until it's clearer what's going to happen in the United States in November, whether it'll be dealing with a new democratic administration a year from now?
Right. Well, I think in Ukraine there always has been, with maybe the exception of like the most sort of fringe left or right understanding, that ideally the country wants to have good relations with all of, you know, its important countries, including, of course, Russia and also United States and the West more generally. I'm not sure as far as like freezing, you know, as and the ambassador said, Ukrainian people have now certainly have majority prefer to have Western orientation, meaning that kind of become a European country, you know, maybe not NATO in the near future, but there is also now ironically following the, for the first time in Ukrainian post-Soviet history, it was following the Russian invasion of Crimea and the events in Donbass, that now majority of people actually support NATO membership. That was never the case before. So sort of the irony of this whole Putin gambit to prevent Ukraine from moving to the West actually made the country more pro-Western, but that's a little bit of a separate point. So as far as kind of freezing, I'm not sure. I mean, I think President Zelensky has been quite careful to not engage in very sort of explosive rhetoric or unnecessarily maybe anti-Russian, or if that's what you are driving at. But ultimately, you know, again, I would second what Ambassador was saying, that if Russia is not prepared to accept Ukraine's right to determine its own future, whatever that future might be, I mean, we are going to have a serious problem as far as, you know, Ukrainian-Russian relations and relations between Russia and the West, because the West rightfully is not willing to give Russia this carte blanche to determine other countries' future, no matter how many Russians might feel emotionally about the importance of Ukraine. So Ukrainian president could certainly pursue pragmatic policy, not to engage in maybe unnecessarily explosive or offensive anti-Russian rhetoric. But when it comes to the national interest, when it comes to the country's right to determine its future, I don't really think there is a possibility of a compromise here.
There's one more point here that's very important, which is why ultimately I think Ukraine will win. The Russian people do not want Russian soldiers fighting in Ukraine. And that's why Putin has to hide his casualties and his military presence there. And what this means is that the historical narrative that we talked about, the Russian historical narrative, is not something that's necessarily going to drive the preferences of the Russian people. And the Russian people know that they are suffering economically because of this war.
Let me take that at face value, seems to comport with everything that I've heard about what's going on. So the kleptocrats in Kyiv depart with the Yanukovych government. The first attempt with the Orange Revolution, and then perhaps for good after the Maidan revolt, sends Yanukovych packing. Does Ukrainian aspiration need continued Russian decrepitude to succeed? I mean, why do we perceive Russia to be playing such a strong hand when there's rot at the heart of the Russian enterprise? Putin has not succeeded in delivering affluence or material comfort or even security to his people. Why is it that we perceive Russia as playing such a strong hand in this kind of question when there appears to be widespread disaffection with what they've been able to pull off so far, Ambassador?
You point out two very important features of contemporary Russian life. On the one side, they failed to develop a modern economy. You have to credit Putin for his macroeconomic policies, which have been stabilizing. But he's on the microeconomic side, he oversees a kleptocracy. And that's led to the inability of the very talented Russian people to produce world-class industrial or post-industrial firms. But on the other hand, on the diplomatic or on the international side, Putin has proved to be tactically very clever. He's able to read his opponents, especially weak-mindedness in the West. And so he's been able to pull off some victories, as in his war on Georgia in 2008, his intervention in Syria, and for that matter, his theft of Crimea. But he misjudged what Ukraine would bear. And that's why, as Oksana laid out, his plans for real conquest in the east of Ukraine failed. And he's now stuck with a situation where he faces sanctions, which cost his economy 1 to 1.25% of GDP per year. This is all reasons for optimism. We have a very strong hand. If we push back against Kremlin aggression, Putin has to fold.
Professor, do you agree?
Well, yes, I think generally I agree. I would just add a couple of things. So first of all, from the perspective of the Russian people, I mean, it is true, as you both said, that, you know, Russia does not have a modern economy. And when Russian people travel, they can see the differences in like healthcare, infrastructure and so forth. On the other hand, right, especially for people who remember the 90s, when, you know, the economic devastation of the first post-war decade, Putin period looks much better. Right, as far as kind of basic stability, availability of basic goods, you know, some improvement in the salaries, you know, pensions being paid on time and that kind of thing. So there is, and that argument, sort of that comparison, and especially since the 1990s was also associated with more competitive, pluralistic politics under Yeltsin, and then we see strengthening authoritarianism under Putin, this kind of trade-off between more democracy / freedom, but, you know, economic instability, social instability, so forth, or, you know, more authoritarian political system, but that comes with some level of stability and security, material security, even though it doesn't quite reach Western standards. So I think, you know, that is part, I mean, not the only one, but that is part of the sort of legitimacy of the Putin self-legitimacy narrative. And I think also, you know, some Russian people are legitimately concerned that if, say, Putin were to leave and there would be some kind of period of political instability, could things turn out worse, right? Like they, and that I think that's exactly where Ukraine comes in, because if Ukraine were to succeed following the uprising against authoritarian leader, following the election of political outsider, following clean, essentially competitive politics and free media, right? If the country also were to succeed economically, like clean house, you know, less corruption, Ukrainians already can travel to the West easier than the Russians, right? That would be really, I think, dangerous for Putin, right? Really dangerous precedent on his borders, even leaving geopolitics like NATO and all of this stuff aside. We have a country that has competitive politics that is very culturally similar to Russia and that also is able to achieve on the economic slash corruption front something Russia has not been able to achieve. So I think there is another maybe impetus, at least on the part of some people, I would think, in the Russian government and kind of Putin's circle, to not have Ukraine succeed that particular way, right? It's one thing that if Ukraine succeeds because Russia helps and gives it cheap oil and, you know, people live better because of this, right? As opposed to if Ukraine succeeds because it has its democratically elected government was able to fight corruption successfully. So I think that's another element.
Well, do you agree with the ambassador? A few minutes ago, he suggested that Ukraine eventually wins. When you heard that, what did you think? Did you think, well, yeah, I can buy that? Or are you a little bit more cautious than that?
I think in some sense, Ukraine already won, right? I mean, if we think of what the situation was in 2014 with an empty treasury, with annexation of Crimea, right, with really many people fearing the country may fall apart. And that has not happened, right? Ukraine had yet another round of successful elections. It still has bipartisan support in the U.S. The Donbas conflict has not been solved, but at least has been contained. We have reasons to be optimistic about Ukraine. Yeah.
Well, Professor, I hear what you're saying, but isn't it also a function of how wide a lens you bring to looking at Ukraine, deciding whether it's in good shape or bad shape or something in between? It's hard to know if you're just a casual student of this part of the world whether Ukraine's up or down. Yeah, as you say, Professor, there are a lot of reasons to be optimistic, but aren't there also, isn't this all still precarious? Isn't Ukraine still fragile? And isn't the United States still figuring out how it's going to play its hand?
Definitely. I mean, Ukraine is never boring. That's one sort of the fun part of studying this part of the world. But I would say, just to answer your question, I think the answer to your question depends of how one defines a success, right, as opposed to a failure or, you know, problem in the country. Because one could say, well, you know, if the most important thing, let's say, some stability, like no matter political regime, no matter, right, some sort of degree of stability. By this metric, even something like Turkmenistan, right, may be considered a success because it's very stable. There are no political upheavals, right? There is no violence, civil war, right? Never mind that one person determines anything and people don't have any say, right? Or a different definition of success might be that we actually have democratic politics and also some degree of, you know, social and political stability and people having a say in what the government is doing, right? So I think in that sense, Ukraine is more successful than many may have expected in the early 1990s when the Soviet Union collapsed, right? And I think another, for Ukraine specifically, a very important definition of success, I think, would be clean politics and decrease in corruption, because that is something people are very concerned about. If you ask people what their priorities are, what the government should be doing, you know, fighting corruption is really high up there. And that's exactly, I think, where Ukraine now has a chance that maybe, kind of ironically somewhat, it may not have had Russia not behaved the way that it did in 2014. Because, again, historically, since 1991, Ukrainian presidents were very adept at playing kind of Russia against the West. And if they, pursued some policies that in the West were considered to be too corrupt, they always had an option of turning to Russia and relying on Russia for support. Now, if we kind of fast forward to post-2014, this really no longer an option. This kind of cozying up to Russia is really not an option to Ukrainian presidents that has been up until then, in part because the attitudes of the population in the country are quite different, right? In part, obviously, because Russia now is controlling part of Ukrainian territory. So in a way, I think it puts more pressure on the Ukrainian leadership to actually live up to the promises it gives to the population. And especially here, Western support would also be very important for the true anti-corruption agenda. Even though I agree with you on the face of it, it looks like what happens to Ukraine in 2014 is really bad. It loses parts of its territory. It now has this conflict fueled by Russia in the east. But, you know, it also somewhat ironically opens new opportunities for the Ukrainian government to rely on this more kind of stronger civic pro-Western sentiment in the country and to really clean house and not go to Russia for the dirty money if and when its own public gets disillusioned with its rulers.
Ambassador, is Ukraine always going to have to be just a little bit anxious about what's being cooked up next door? Or is there a point at which Ukraine manages to navigate the dangerous waters of the next few years, more reliable friends elsewhere in the world, and sort of seize off the threat from Russia?
I think Ukraine will always have to be concerned with what's happening in Moscow. And in fact, Ukraine's premier strategic thinker, Volodymyr Herbulin, has said precisely Ukraine needs to be in NATO because that's the only way Russia will stop interfering in Ukraine. Having said that, the United States, for all the ebbs and flows of our policy, especially last year, has been consistently supportive of Ukraine. So has the EU. And they've proved to be, by and large, reliable friends.
So what do you see in the near future?
I think there are two, actually, as it's been true for the last 6 years, there are two huge issues in Ukraine. One is the war with Moscow. The other is reform. I think we've seen with the new President Zelensky a strong effort to move on reform, not without some mistakes, not without some bows to corruption, but on balance, a pretty good effort. And I think that we'll see more of this. And the U.S. and the EU will be very supportive as Ukraine heads in that direction. On the war, I've already given you my bottom line, which I think Putin's going to have to withdraw at some point. But that some point probably is not going to be at least for 2 years. He's hoping President Trump is going to not just survive impeachment, but win a second term. And he's hoping that President Trump will have a very soft policy towards Moscow and not such a supportive policy of Ukraine towards Ukraine in a second term. If Trump is a second term president, Putin will be disappointed for reasons I've already described. And then give Putin 6 to 12 months to assimilate that. And maybe he could then decide 2 or so years from now to get out. Or alternatively, he could continue to try to win this war in Ukraine unsuccessfully.
Professor, does the Trump-Putin relationship still have the potential to expose Ukraine to heavy pressure, either by Trump's attention or his inattention?
Again, I think we come back to this point of the importance of bipartisan support and that Ukraine has always received it. So even if Trump were to be reelected for the second term, yes, I think that would be, you know, probably more beneficial to Putin than it would be to Ukraine. But again, I think Trump, just as he has been in the first term, would be constrained by other actors in the Ukrainian, in American domestic politics to just do maybe some pro-Russian policy that he wishes to do, right? But certainly, you know, that would be something that they would be watching in Ukraine. And if the support is lukewarm from American president, that is not going to be a positive thing for Ukraine.
Professor Oksana Shevel of Tufts University, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Ambassador John Herbst of the Atlantic Council, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs. We're more than a program. We're a nonprofit membership organization that is dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter and to give people the tools and understanding to make sense of a rapidly transforming world. Please join our community and visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured John Herbst. He was U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine from 2003 to 2006. Now he's director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. And Oksana Shevel. She is professor of political science at Tufts University. Earlier, Ray spoke with filmmaker and journalist Simon Ostrovsky. He recently returned from a reporting trip in Ukraine for the PBS NewsHour. World Affairs is produced in partnership with KQED. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our producer is Jared Sport. And our executive producer is Joanne Jennings. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for joining us.